I think in a way my heart really melted when I was with them. And so it's wonderful to have a way of a venue of doing that. But I think what was really a key for me there was that, again, an illusion left me of separateness. And when I saw people who were just like me walking around, and I imagined myself, I saw that in a real sense, that was me, that mother looking for her child, you know, trying to get medical care for her child, or just trying to get food on the table. And those women in the market were me, that wall. Christine came up and said, you know, this oneness is, it is, that's the truth of it. They are my sisters and brothers, you know, I am in some way intimately connected with them, their lives. So, those are three ways that I've found to, you know, things that have been meaningful for me. So now I just invite you to take, maybe until 11:30, it's about 7 minutes, and just turn to the person next to you, just do this together with each other, and if you're sitting next to yourself, you may want to turn the other way.
Open heart surgery.
Okay,
meditation.
Conscientious objection in the Vietnam War.
Hey. One of our friends did that and went to jail.
Going to jail, I hear. Quite a lot of changing experience.
Yeah. And the Delano grape strike and the march to Sacramento, which I participated in, about 12 miles of it. And it was really an experience.
Yeah. Alice said something, cultivated an awareness of love in an away cart. That was something you read before you started. And speaks to the one thing I wanted to say is that in the last year and a half I take these walks on the Wilcox property, and I kind of call them meditative mindful walks, but I think there's a way, been a way for me to walk, it's a small thing, but by myself in nature that I feel like I'm awake and I'm experiencing divine and sort of a sense of the world in a unique way. And it's a little thing, and you don't have to go to the Wilcox, you can walk around the block or you can go in your backyard and sit, but I think that being awake to nature and it is a really has been a vehicle for me that's really made a big difference in the last year and a half, especially.
Mm-hmm. Many years ago, I saw a movie about nuclear war. It was about 40 years ago, and that converted me to pacifism. Mm-hmm. It was not a regular movie because the government tried to keep it out. They saw it nihilistic. Pretty terrifying.
Mm-hmm. So you experience an interior shift.
Right.
We saw. Yeah. I think that's a trustworthy sign that, you know, that our paths are true, that we understand ourselves to be changing and to be somehow different. And then that effect, I was with that pacifist ever after that. He said, you know, it changes you not just for the moment, but on.
A big change came for me in working with the disabled, that there's a social justice of people who've been marginalized not through their own choice. Mm-hmm. They've lost control, over their lives, their security, everything, and they feel they don't belong anymore. Mm-hmm. And that really struck me, is how do we get these people back into the mainstream, mm-hmm. feeling that they're worth something?
Mm-hmm. And how do we connect with people?
Yeah.
How do people who are not, you know, fully able physically or mentally, how are they us? You know, what are the pieces of us that are that way? Yeah, I remember a woman at a religious ed conference talking about she was blind and confined to a wheelchair, and she pointed out that most of us at some point would not be able to get around on our own, and that, you know, so she had much to tell us as we prepared for our own aging and kind. I thought that was pretty, mm-hmm. pretty bold and pretty true. Chris?
For me, it was the moment. I think traveling outside of this culture is really important. So I was handing out booklets about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at World Social Forum in Bombay. And this gentleman came up to me, and so I gave him a booklet. He said, well, what does this have to do with me? Something to do with every single human being. And he looked at me and he said, oh, you don't understand. And I didn't know what he was referring to, and so I kind of stayed quiet. And he said, I'm Dali. I'm untouchable. I'm not a human being. And God, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. It opened my eyes. I wasn't an Indian, so this wasn't part of my culture, but it opened my eyes to the fact that I put labels on things that are just as bad as Dalit, and function as if that's a reality. And if I can step out of those labels and see the human being, that was critical. And it was just a massive moment in my life.
Wow.
Okay. I think that one of the first moments for me was when my grandmother died, and I was young. I was so shocked by it. I think I was maybe 8 or 9. I was so shocked by death because she was laid out in our home, and I'd been real close to her. And so I remember standing by the casket all the time during the wake, and in those days they let children stay up all night during the wake or whatever. And my mother getting a pillow and putting it under her casket and letting me sleep there. Mm-hmm. And it was such, I felt an affinity with death through that. And that was really, I think that colored my whole life. And that oneness. Because it was maybe not just oneness with everyone else that came later, but oneness with someone that had passed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lori?
I had an experience recently that just will not leave me, and it has to do with the view of immigrants. And this person I was having lunch with told me the story of this newspaper article where an immigrant person was hired to come and build the roof on a house, and as he was coming there, he was attacked by a dog, and the dog then became an issue in the public, and so the dog was going to be put to sleep because he had attacked a human being and severely. And all of a sudden in the media they discovered he was an undocumented immigrant, and it was like the dog became a hero. And this person, and I just went, oh my gosh, what? And when you think about it, you listen to some of the channels on TV, the way immigrants are spoken, it's like they're inhuman, they're less than human. And that story just really compels me to do something to help in the education and changing people's attitudes towards immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think over and over again how scapegoating makes us less human. You know, when we try to fewer, as you know, as you're pointing to, reading about them, you know, those people as if they're less than, you know, how that makes us, how that diminishes us.
Years ago, I worked with homeless people, and discovered one day, instead of there being smelly, dirty, scary objects, as I looked into the eyes of one of the people I was working with, I realized that person was precious and what I could call a subject. And that realization helped me to go from the human being subject, not object, that you can deal with as a thing, to realizing that's the way we as a people tend to treat nature. And so it began my switch to seeing nature as people, as one.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned Al Anon years and years ago, in my 20s. I went to an AA meeting with a family member, and I don't think the Al Anon was around at the time, and so we began going every week. And, you know, with alcoholism being a systemic disease, of course, you know, I was as affected by it as my dad, actually. And so there was a real experience of acceptance and welcoming. And I think because of going to that, and I did for over a year with him, sometimes twice a week. But I always said that during this time it was like a religious experience, much more than my Catholicism. I would say it was probably the purest religious experience I've had to that point. And began, I think, a path to wholeness because of that, most because of that acceptance and looking around at people and seeing the diversity of the people in the room sometimes was really amazing. But knowing that we are one and have a real connection, mm-hmm. wonderful gift.
One of the things I've said to people as they come in, newcomers to the program, is that you may not like all of us, but you will come to love us, mm-hmm. just as we love you already. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that whole thing of there are slogans and they're cliches, but lots of times cliches are cliches because they're true. And this whole thing of fake it till you make it is one of the things that they say, and I think that sometimes, that just fake it till you make it. He has a whole chapter of letting go. First chapter that's very interesting, even letting go of our own practices, our own. You know, he goes on and on, and this whole letting go and letting God, I think it does, at least I really need a high degree of security and control to feel as though I'm in charge of things, and that's a kind of a constant battle.
One of the incidents that I had in my life was the most, I was hesitating to get myself involved and move on it. I was going to Los Angeles about 4 o'clock in the morning because we had a meeting over there. And there's this car in the freeway upside down with the lights on. And there's not too many cars. But I saw it. I'm the first one there. So I said, I have to go out there and see if there's anybody in there. Which I did. I had some flares in the car. So I got out and I looked and I couldn't see anybody else. Finally, I did saw a car coming down, and that was on the freeway. However, it wasn't that busy. I said, will you stop? Because I've got to go call the police, and here's the flares, and I'll do what you have to do. I've got to get to the telephone. And at the time when you decide, should I or shouldn't I? But there's just nobody else, you know. So you do what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes you don't even have time to think. You're just there, and you're
I was watching a segment on 60 Minutes on Sunday on what's happening to women in, I forget what part of Africa, Sudan or wherever, the raping of women as a use by those in power to control. I mean, it was hard to watch. It was hard to watch. It just, I'm not involved in the women's movement as such, but this kind of thing really cuts to the core of what it means to be human. And I don't think the church is doing quite enough or could do more when the quotes up on the board, and I'm sorry to keep dragging this home, but all the quotes in the Catholic social teaching, which is the best social teaching there is, but we don't really practice this in our own structures. For the Catholic social teaching to say Christ in all things, to see Christ in all persons, and then to say, but only half of you can really sacramentally represent Christ in the world, keeps that role of women held down. If the church, who's supposed to represent God, does not raise up women as Jesus did. In fact, Beatrice Bruteau, when I was talking to her on Saturday, she said, what one thing did Jesus do that you can't find any other huge religious leader doing, of his time or before? And, he loved his enemies, died for them. Oh, now Buddha did that.
That's why Buddha did.
So I was trying to think, she said, he's the only one that raised up women to equal status. And if that's true, I haven't researched it, but I'm sure she has. Some of my angst with the church is, and it's been for me, you can talk about a small step, just walking from here up to the front and turning around as a woman in the Catholic Church and speaking publicly to a group was a life-threatening moment for me 26 years ago. Because I didn't belong up there in front. And that you can stand here and give this beautiful, inspiring presentation, but you couldn't do it at homily at Sunday Mass. There's angst about, you talk about loving and what are the barriers inside ourselves that keep us from that. I'd like the institutional church to ask itself, how could we more deeply love by lowering these barriers of the status and role of women in our church? Somebody recently that I don't know very well, it's only a casual relationship with, took me aside, looked me straight in the eye, and said, the best thing you can do is to promote the role of women in your church. I mean, just said that so strongly, I couldn't miss it. You know, talking about small steps, I'd love for the institutional church to take that step of really allowing women to sacramentally represent Christ and to raise up what it means to be human is to be male and female, both.
Well, remember this, hold on. Remember that we are part of the system. You know, we are part of the church. And as we are kind of having our consciousness raised here, we talk to each other. The church is changing. It's a different church than it was.
The program that she's speaking about, it was very, very horrible. I happened to be watching it, and then I told my tenant, 26 years old, I said, I want you to watch this. And after he sat down, tears were coming down my face, and I felt so guilty even asking him to come and see it. Because sometimes they say, well, they're always against men, you know, this kind of thing. But it was the most horrific thing.
Well, one of the things that was new to me was they take these women out and they bring the entire family and village to watch this gang rape. And why do they do that? Because they do it for power to say, this is what's going to happen to you if you don't, you know, do what we want. And what it does to the men is it emasculates the men because they're powerless to help the women. And so the men leave. The men end up can't relating to this woman because they're so guilty because they haven't been able to fulfill their role as men to protect their families. And it totally destroys the entire structure of the people in that village.
Well, and I think a change that we can point to is that this is on 60 Minutes. Yeah. And so just as, you know, Jude watched a film and it changed him, you know, in terms of his stance for the rest of his life. There are people who watch 60 Minutes who are going to know some ways, who are going to take some steps. And certainly everybody here cares about it and knows about it on a level we would never have. I mean, there was a time when it was deepest, darkest Africa, and it was totally other.
Mm-hmm. The question that I feel coming up in me around this is the question we started with today. How can I learn to love the way Jesus did? And I think that Jesus would have found how to love even those perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow I want to be able to make that leap, not to accept their actions, but to find them as being human.
Yeah, that's a terrific point. And that was part of his brilliance, you know. Jesus didn't just go for the good people. He said, it's the one, you know, the lost sheep. The last sheet that I need to come to, Nancy.
One really small thing that kind of hit home with me was on a Sunday after I'd been to a few masses by the gas station and got gas, and then there was a homeless fellow asking for money, and I said, I'm sorry, I just gave my last dollar to church. And I was so embarrassed because I felt like no matter what, I have a roof over my head and I have food in the refrigerator, even if it's just eggs and milk. And anyway, so I gave him my rosary from Medjugorje that someone had given me two of, and I just heard the scripture that said, if you have two coats, give one of them away. So I'm like, all right, I've got one in my car and one at home, I'll give this one away. And I said, perhaps it will create a miracle for you. You know, pray on it. And he said, oh, someone years ago gave me a little guardian angel medallion. And I looked at him and I'm like, I give those away too. Perhaps it was me. Your guardian angel. I said, perhaps it was me. And he pulled it out of his pocket, and it was so, like, kind of rusty and dirty. I knew it was really old, and I'd only been doing it for a few years now. And he said, I've been carrying this around with me for 10 years.
Oh, my God.
And it almost made me cry because I thought, here is a simple thing like a guardian angel medallion that this homeless person has been carrying for 10 years. And you can imagine the circumstances that he's lived in for 10 years. He's probably an army vet. You know, he's probably a veteran. But it made me realize that maybe someone, the perfect stranger that I gave the guardian angel thing to, maybe it helps them through difficult circumstances also to let them know that God's always there for them no matter what.
Mm-hmm. That connection they have to them.
So there's always something little you can do for someone.
Yeah. And you don't know what effect that will have.
For the past several decades, I've been visiting subacute care patients in the hospital. Subacute care patients are people who are in vegetative state, persistent vegetative state. Typically they don't talk, walk, have no muscle control, are unable to communicate in any way. And a small group of people here in Santa Barbara, which I'm fortunately one, get to visit these people and acknowledge that despite their deficiencies, they're human beings. Well, it changes you. I wasn't prepared when I started it to realize I could love a person who had never made the slightest movement toward me or toward anyone else.
Beautiful ministry. Thank you for that sharing, teaching, and I think what you said.
It just made me think about when I was maybe eighth grade and in the Sodality in a Catholic school, and
we organized a trip to what was called a poor farm, you know. Mm-hmm. Older people who had no place else to go were put in this old house, and I've never forgotten it. It smelled, people were, looked like they didn't have clothes enough to keep them warm. We brought some food and we sang some songs for them, but I've never forgotten it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Four get away, you could never have known the time.
No.
Dorothy?
I'm really grateful for all the personal development groups that I have been connected with in Santa Barbara, Crucio, CFM, even the Charismatic Movement. And, you know, it's just like, it's been there, grassroots. You know, Bible study, grassroots. And I think, look at the changes that has happened from the grassroots.
Amen, sister.
Mary, we only have a few minutes left. Uh-huh. Could you please tie this together? You know, we've spent a lot of time sharing, mm-hmm. and it's wonderful to hear what everyone has to say. But I would really like to hear you summarize a lot of, you know, if we're going to read this book, I would really like some of your reflections on that, please.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, the way I intended to finish was with the last page of the fourth chapter. And I thought that image was so apt. He talks about a giant ocean liner. He says, we're like a giant ocean liner that's come loose from its moorings and is drifting out to sea. The dangers ahead are incalculable. Are we heading for shipwreck and extinction? Some want to return to the safety of the harbor. We can't do that. It's impossible. Some kind of sea out on the horizon, you know, a beautiful future, but we can't see that either. And then what he says is that these dangers remain. The ship's leaking. Some are trying to repair the leak. Others are creating new leaks and ignoring the icebergs ahead of us. When I read this, I thought of, you know, how the movie of Titanic captured in the imagination of people all over the world. Was so strong for us, and I wonder if it has something subliminally to do with this. But Nolan says there's no storm at sea. Nature is not hostile to us. The storm is on board between the passengers, each of us blindly pursuing his or her own agenda. And I think, you know, that for me is where it ties. If we don't begin to really foster this kind of, you know, get rid of the locks that our egos, our need for control, our need for security, our need for being an important person, and foster those ways in us that will let us, help us to see the connection, things that people have shared, even from people that you would least expect, people who have disabilities, people who are in a persistent vegetative state, people who are addicted, people who are in Kenya, you know, people who are in our neighborhood drives crazy. You know, until we come to foster that kind of unity and oneness and a desire to not see the differences and not be separate, but to really seek how we can be in this together, how we're on this boat together. He says, who is steering this ship? Who's in control? It's in this context, at this moment in the evolution of our universe, that we're invited to consider anew and take seriously the spiritual wisdom of Jesus, and goes on to be continued. So I learned a lot from just dwelling on these thoughts, and just again appreciate so much the invitation, and ask us to sing the last song, which I think does point to where our ocean liner is going. Thank you.